From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Last week, counselors visited students and met with over 100 parents at Clearfield High School as the community reeled from the suicides of two students within a week. It's the kind of intervention that's all too common in Utah, where suicide is the second leading cause of death among teens, and where the suicide rate has been higher than the national rate for the past decade. Some blame social pressures. Others link the numbers to the altitude, the economy, or a host of untreated mental illnesses. Today on the program, we're talking about understanding suicide, recognizing warning signs, and coping with a loss. Plus, preparing for a healthcare crisis and the end of life. We'll discuss advanced care directives. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Suicide. It's not easy to talk about, and it's not particularly pleasant. But the reality is that nearly 500 Utahns die from suicide each year, and 8 adults are rushed to Utah ERs every day because of suicide attempts. Today on the program, we're exploring the reasons behind Utah's high suicide rate, ways to prevent suicide, and how to deal with the issues when you're left behind. Joining me this hour is Dr. Doug Gray. He is professor of psychiatry at the University of Utah School of Medicine. And Dr. Gray, thanks for your time today. Also with us, Doug Thomas, the assistant director of the Utah Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. And Doug, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Jennifer.
And Greg Hudnall, he's the associate superintendent of Provo School District. All three of these gentlemen, members of the State Suicide Prevention Task Force. Greg, great to have you here.
Great, thank you.
Up later in the program, we're going to be talking about healthcare directives and how to make sure your end-of-life medical wishes are met. But first, suicide. Has your life been touched by the suicide of a loved one? Have you felt desperate yourself? And how did you recover? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Greg Hudnall, I want to start with you. The Clearfield High School community has been rocked recently by two suicides within a week. I understand you've been down in Kanab doing some similar counseling sessions with that community. What can you tell us about recent teen suicides that we've seen in the state?
You know, it's a concern for us as educators and mental health workers across the state of Utah. Unfortunately, when you look at the statistics across the country, we're 9th overall out of all 50 states, and then add Washington, D.C. to that. This is a stressful time for a lot of teenagers and those that are struggling with mental illness and stress in their life. And it's a concern for us that we're trying to help educate parents and the community and school districts on how to support them, how to provide some prevention, and how to intervene with help.
How are the students at Clearfield and down in Kanab, how are they doing, and what do parents want to know?
You know, any time that we lose a child, it's a loss to the entire community. And I think you have the peers that are struggling because of the loss of a friend. I think the most difficult part for parents are when you lose a child to suicide, sometimes you never know whether there was, you know, a note that was not left, or you always wonder if there's something that I could have done to prevent that. And I think that's the biggest struggle that schools and communities are having of what could we have done, what should we have done. And in Clearfield, the schools handled it very well. They were involved with the community. The crisis team did very well. And it's unfortunate when we lose a child to suicide.
Greg Hudnall mentioned that Utah stands at 9th in the nation. Give us some other statistics, Doug Thomas, about the numbers. 8th highest adult suicide rate, 12th highest teen suicide rate. What strikes you about these numbers?
Well, Jennifer, these numbers are all too high because suicide is a preventable public health problem. And so what we're trying to do is to address it in that manner. In Utah, about 15.2 people per 100,000 commit suicide. And in the United States, it's about 11 per 100,000. So we are on the high end, and we know some of the factors that play into that, but we're trying to prevent it, and really getting the word out that if you know someone or feel like you someone in your life is contemplating it, to talk to them about it. It's not taboo, even though sometimes in our community or culture we don't address this. Addressing it will not make the person do it. It will actually help them be able to talk about what's going on and address the issue.
Demographically, more young people versus old people. Is it returning veterans? Can you kind of sift that out for us?
Actually, the rate is highest in 75 years old and older, and then it also is high in males, kind of between the ages of 15 to 40. So there's a couple spots where it's high. Females typically attempt suicide more often, but males more often actually do end up taking their lives.
And is that just in Utah or is that nationally?
That's nationally, and a lot of that has to do with the means that they take to do that. It's more lethal, and so often it results in death as opposed to some of the less lethal means that may result in hospitalization and may impact you in other ways physically, but So we're really concerned about these issues and want people to know if they know someone that's struggling with this, reducing access to lethal means is a helpful thing. You know, putting gun locks and storing your gun and your ammunition in separate places and maybe even taking them for a time away from the person or not limiting their access, as well as prescription drugs. Those are the two main ways that people do die by suicide.
What about geography? I've read that suicides tend to cluster. It's almost like a contagion. Is there any truth to that?
Yes, definitely. Suicide does have a contagion factor, and that's why postvention activities are so important, like what Greg and the staff up at the Davis School District and Davis Behavioral Health did for the community to limit that. In Utah, the percentage of suicides is actually highest in rural areas and not in the urban areas. And some of that has to do with access to health care. And so we want to encourage people to seek care. If you had a toothache, you would go to the dentist. If your foot hurt, you'd go to your doctor. Well, if you're hurting emotionally or mentally and struggling with something, you should go and see a mental health professional.
We're speaking with Doug Thomas, Assistant Director of the Utah Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health, also Greg Hudnall, the Associate Superintendent of the Provo School District, and Dr. Doug Gray, Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Utah. Dr. Gray, Utah has the highest rate of suicidal thoughts, so people are not only completing the act, but they're thinking a lot about it. About one in 15 adults seriously has considered killing themselves in the past year. How do you translate that data?
I don't know how we translate the suicidal thoughts data. We don't have any science to reflect on that and understand that. We do have a high completed suicide rate in Utah. We've done more research in that area, and that is that the Rocky Mountain states have higher suicide rates than other regions of the country. And for many years I'd go give talks and I would mention that, you know, why is Nevada, Colorado, Utah, these states, why do they have higher rates than other regions of the country? Perry Renshaw, who's another scientist at the university, was sitting in on one of those lectures and he mentioned that there are metabolic processes that occur at high altitude that may make depression more treatment resistant in some people. After that discussion, he started studying this and he's found a very strong correlation between altitude and suicide rates, which is quite remarkable. Perry's also an international scientist and he's worked with a group in South Korea and they've looked at altitude and suicide and found the exact same correlation in a country with a completely different culture. So the main factors for suicide completion are mental illness, you know, access to firearms, lack of treatment, people that are ill but don't get treatment. But we should also add this altitude factor into the equation, which is quite interesting.
Hmm. We're talking about the causes of suicide, why Utah has such a high rate, and how to prevent it. 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255 if you'd like to join us. And we'll go to Gary in Murray, Utah. Gary, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Over the weekend, I saw an episode on a TV show captured on a police car video as they attempted and fortunately successfully intervened in this woman who was determined to jump off a bridge. And they saved her and interviewed her afterwards. And her postpartum depression was so intense that she described a complete lack of awareness of anything but her determination to get to that bridge and jump. And I wondered if your speakers could address the frequency of postpartum depression in Utah, where we have such a high birth rate, and whether there's a correlation with that in women. And how do we get a woman who is so blinded to everything else but that depression to actually get help? Thank you.
Gary, thanks for the call. Dr. Gray, the role that postpartum depression may have in suicide attempts or completed acts.
You know, I'm a child psychiatrist, but when I trained in adult psychiatry, some of the worst depressions I've ever seen, and sometimes psychotic depressions, were in postpartum women. And we do have very high birth rates, and to my knowledge nobody in Utah has or at any universities looked at that particular issue, comparing Utah maybe to other states. I think that's a very interesting aspect, and I think it'd be worth studying. I'm glad the caller asked that question.
Mm-hmm. Greg Hudnall?
You know, go along with that, and I think Gary's question was good. When people deal with depression, it gets to the point where it's so overwhelming that they see few options. Dr. Ken Tuttle, a psychiatric director for IHC, talks about the concept where there's only two options: learn to live with the pain or make the pain go away. And that's why it's so important, like Doug mentioned earlier, that we educate the community. When you see these individuals struggling, especially suicide occurs in the context of a stressful event. So if there's a chance that you can intervene or others can intervene, there is a good chance that we can get help and prevent that suicide. Mm.
Gary, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255. This call is from John in Park City. He couldn't stay on the line, but his question is, how does religion factor in with the statistics with LDS and non-LDS suicides? Gentlemen?
Yes.
Dr. Gray.
There have been some suicidologists nationally that look at religion, and what they find is that if you're a Baptist and you live in an area where the Baptists live, your suicide rate is slightly decreased. It's not a big influence. It's a small one. Or if you're Catholic and you live in the Catholic portion of Boston, your suicide rate would be, you know, slightly decreased. So, and they haven't looked at for instance, the LDS population per se, but people that have looked nationally at religion and suicide have found a slight protective factor in being around more folks of your same faith, where you might get more support.
Mm. This email from Steve in Salt Lake City: it's no surprise to me that Utah has one of the highest suicide rates in the country. The social and religious pressures in our community can be suffocating to anyone who happens to be different. I felt it as a teen, and sadly, I continue to see it in the community, especially among people with a particularly religious upbringing. And I remember a couple of years ago, there were two or three there was a string of suicides among gay teens and gay men who took their lives. They, you know, those who survived were blaming the conservative environment. I'm wondering if the research supports that. Different lifestyles, different values, in an overwhelmingly conservative community. Greg Hednall?
You know, Jennifer, I think it does. And just like Dr. Gray mentioned, that the suicide rates will go down with that pressure from religion if there's a support system. It's that isolation. And when you look at the top 10 states that deal with the highest percentage of suicide completion rate, you see very isolated communities, isolated individuals. And when individuals are trying to be successful or be accepted in their community, whether it's a school, neighborhood, or church, and there is lack of acceptance, then that depression level tends to go up and can pressure them into those situations where they feel helpless and they feel hopeless.
Greg Hednall, he's the Associate Superintendent of the Provo School District. Also with us, Doug Thomas, Assistant Director of the Utah Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health, and Dr. Doug Gray, a Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Utah. We're talking about suicide, how to prevent it, how to cope with it when it happens to someone you love. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Utah continues to have one of the highest suicide rates in the U.S. What is driving the trend? And how can families, schools, and communities cope with the loss of a loved one, a friend, a colleague who's taken their own life? Today on the program, we're discussing the warning signs of suicide and how to get help. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. With us in studio, Dr. Doug Gray, Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Utah, Doug Thomas, Assistant Director of the Utah Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health, and Greg Hednall, Associate Superintendent of Provo School District. All three are members of the State Suicide Prevention Task Force. Let's talk about antidepressants. I've seen some studies that say that young people, if they are taking Prozac or Effexor or some other depressive medication, that actually increases the risk of suicide. Other studies say no link, there's not increased incidence of suicide. The FDA put a black box warning on some of these medications. I'm just wondering where things stand right now. Dr. Doug Gray.
Sure. For about three or four decades, the teen suicide rate was increasing steadily. And then in the mid-1990s, as we used more antidepressants in kids who had the more severe type depressions, the rate started to decline gradually. And then about 2004, 2005, there was the black box, talk about the black box warning, then the black box warning. And I think the black box warning maybe was good because about 2% of people that take an antidepressant have a bad reaction to it. You know, 75 to 80% get better. So the odds ratio is really good for taking an antidepressant. But unfortunately, when the black box warning came out, a lot of primary care doctors, pediatricians, and some psychiatrists reduced their use of antidepressants for children and adolescents. And right after that, we saw the largest increase in suicide in our country's history for adolescents. Just a huge spike, and then it happened the next year. And we also saw this happen in other countries when they had a black box warning. So here's the deal. Depression is a really terrible thing, and it takes the lives of a lot of our kids. But if we treat those kids, if we treat 40, one of them is going to get worse. 39 get better, one gets worse. You know, that's the ratio. But the black box warning first should have said that depression is a terrible thing, and depression takes kids. There should be a black box warning out on depression, right? But instead, it was just a black box warning on the medication. It scared a lot of doctors from using the medications because of liability and also concerns about their patients. Am I making my patient worse? And because of that, we had this huge spike in the suicide rate. So we have to be respectful of the fact that 2% of the kids will get worse, but more respectful of the fact that depression kills.
801-355-TALK is our number, and we'll go back to the phone. Sydney is calling us from Salt Lake. Sydney, hello.
Hi. I've had, I'm at an age where a lot of my family has experienced a lot of different things, but we have one side of our family that has experienced mental illness with a number of different kinds of problems. In a couple of cases, it's been bipolar. In one, it's been bipolar with drug overdose problems. In none of these cases have they been teenagers. They've all been adults. The problem that we've had with this is that one of the real signs of depression is that the person's not able to reason enough to say, I need to get to a doctor. I need help. Someone has to be there to take them to the doctor or to get them admitted to the hospital. And yet the whole system is set up against that. Just incredible frustration in trying to tell doctors that this person is addicted to pain pills and has been taking pain pills and has been doctor shopping. They don't listen. They don't care. And in a couple of instances, we've got people in hospitals for suicide attempts, and they keep them for a certain period of days, and then the person, you know, it says, oh, everything's fine. They kind of learn to play the game, and they're out. And they'll go from being locked up 1 hour, and an hour later, they've handed them their car keys and said, hope everything gets better for you, and sends them off. It's just the most frustrating thing I've ever had to deal with. We've had to deal with it more than once. It wasn't just one bad case that resulted in suicide in a hospital, by the way, where he was allowed to commit suicide, even provided the equipment to do it. And the other problems in that family have just been excruciating. And we finally almost have to walk away because we can't do anything for them, and the system doesn't allow us to. The system doesn't say to us, do you think we ought to keep them in the hospital longer? The system says, well, we've held them for, you know, a certain number of days, and there's nothing, you know, if they want to leave, they can leave. And they walk away, or they get up and leave, and the hospital says there's nothing we can do about it. They're so concerned about protecting the rights of the sick person that they don't allow the family to get them any help.
Sydney, thank you very much for sharing your story. She brought up a number of issues. One is the drug addiction part of this. And you, Doug Thomas, you talked about how this really is a public health issue. It's not a private matter. Can you address some of the issues that Sydney brought up?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for calling, Sydney. And I'm sorry that things have been so tough with that side of your family. The balance there between someone's civil liberties and mandating treatment are always a very touchy issue. And the civil commitment laws in Utah try to really place those in the forefront and say, okay, if this person is a danger, a substantial danger to themselves or others, then we can deprive them of their civil liberties and hospitalize them involuntarily against their will. And there is a way for you to be involved in that process. A police officer or a mental health officer in the county in which you live can involuntarily hospitalize someone who they deem is a danger to themselves or others because of a mental illness. And that's where it gets difficult oftentimes. Mental illness and substance abuse is more often co-occurring than not. And so you have to demonstrate that the psychological distress that they're going through is due to the effects of the mental illness. And it, some professionals have a hard time if there's drugs and alcohol involved with saying it's because of the mental illness. But really, we know that the rates of suicide attempts and deaths both go up with alcohol and drug use. And so it really is, Sydney, you're right on. It is a big risk factor if they have a mental illness and also an alcohol or drug problem. And so I would encourage you to contact a lot of the local police departments have been training in this area as well, as they get a lot of calls that deal with these types of situations. And they have special trained officers that are called CIT officers, crisis intervention trained officers, that can have had training through our local mental health authorities and through the state CIT program run by the Salt Lake City Police Department to intervene and really help individuals get treatment and get the help that they need to avoid suicide or other negative outcomes because of mental health issues.
So. What about Sydney's point that the system really is rigged against ongoing care, though? If you bring somebody into the ER who's clearly suicidal, they get hospitalized for a couple of days and then let go and say, good luck, Dr. Gray.
Well, it's very different when you look at adolescents versus adults. For adolescents, the decision is made by the physician and the parents together. So an adolescent may have made a serious suicide attempt, and the next day they say, I'm fine, I'm not depressed, I'm doing well, and the parents and the doctor say, no, you're here. And care tends to be, those decisions are made by people that care about the person, but the adolescent doesn't make the decision. With adult psychiatry, there's an opportunity for some crisis work in the hospital. I actually agree hospitalizations are too short now. When I started doing psychiatry, people looked pretty good when they left the hospital, and now it's more just putting out the crisis. It's a difficult problem. Everything is weighted to the freedom of the individual. I've had a few young adults where the parents have gotten power of attorney to make medical decisions. They've gone through court and said, my child is an adult now, but has schizophrenia or has, some mental illness that's incapacitating, and we need to make those decisions. So I've seen that work sometimes. I think with older adults, I think a decision happens when they're in the hospital. It is a crisis, situation, and if they say in their mind, it's time, I need to get help, I need to make change, I think they can make to do very well. But there isn't a lot. They have to make that decision at some point to want help and want those services. So.
Greg Hudnall?
One of the concerns I have, Doug, and I think we're seeing a decrease every year, is the availability of beds. Even down in Kanab, when I went down and worked with their community, they're wanting to put together a prevention intervention program, so when they identify these young people who are at risk, there aren't enough beds in our state. And in a lot of situations, especially in rural areas, they go on a waiting list. And so, what Sydney is talking about is real. And it's unfortunate for these families that are dealing with crisis situation that they go to the emergency room, they're evaluated, given some meds, or treated for that hour, and then pushed back on the family to deal with. And it's something that I see continuing to grow, not decrease. And it does frighten me.
801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We're talking about suicide interventions and prevention. And we'll go back to the phones. This is an anonymous caller from Salt Lake City. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for the good program.
Sure.
I wanted to address the idea of stigma. I think there's a lot of stigma in our society regarding mental illness or brain dysfunction, however you want to define it. And I think there's no faster way to clear a room than to announce that it's kind of like someone who's coming out. You know, if you mention that you are depressed, or heaven forbid that you are thinking of, taking your own life, then there's a lot of stigma where people don't want to, they're so uncomfortable, they don't even know what to say, and so they stay away from you. And so it's kind of like, everybody that, people that would need the help the most are the least likely to be able to reach out and say anything. And so, that you've talked about the idea of isolation, and that will drive a person to be isolated as well when they don't feel, like they can fit into society, and society doesn't know what to do with them.
Are you speaking from personal experience?
I am. Mm-hmm. And
so, what have you done to reach out to people and get help?
Well, I went through a personal crisis, and I moved back to Utah from out of state. So that was a good thing, because I was very isolated where I had moved in a new marriage. And my reason for moving there fell apart, and so all of a sudden I was very isolated in a very big, cold city. And so it was very nice to be back by family and friends. But I still feel like it's hard to fit in, because I'm not the same as I was. Circumstances have changed, and there's a little bit of, humiliation and and the feeling of, you know, that something's wrong with you. I think a lot of people feel that way, that there is something wrong with you. They don't think that way about someone taking heart medication, but if you're taking antidepressants, then there's something wrong with you. And that's kind of, I guess, the point that I wanted to make.
Thank you very much for the call, and good luck to you. Dr. Gray.
Well, when we did the Utah Youth Suicide Study, we actually interviewed parents, siblings, friends, coaches, teachers, and asked, you know, well, this person, this adolescent died of suicide. What was the biggest barrier to treatment? And I was wrong, because I thought it would be, it's hard to find a psychiatrist, which is true, or it's the hospital bed wasn't available, which is true, or our insurance wouldn't pay well for psychiatry, which is true. But it turned out that the top ones were all related to stigma. Johnny was embarrassed about his mental illness, or Sally didn't think anything could help her. Those kind of questions rose to the top. And interestingly, the people that were looking at those barriers, whether it was the parents, the siblings, the friends, they all had those as the top barriers. Once you get past that and you look at people that did try to get help, then you run into all the other problems. They couldn't afford the prescription, or they couldn't get into a doctor, and all those other things. But the first barrier we've got to get through is the stigma barrier.
And I agree as well. Talking about mental health issues is sometimes talking about the elephant in the room. We all deal with stress in our society today, and all have supports and helps that keep us healthy mentally, or that help strengthen us or buoy us up when we're stressed out or need that. And one in four people in America today will have a mental illness at some point in their lives. And mental illness is really a disease that strikes young people. 50% of all mental illnesses are you're able to diagnose by age 14, and 75% by age 24. And so really looking at our young people and our young adults that are transitioning, we need to pay attention to them and provide them with support, both in our families and in our communities, and give them opportunities. And not I love the show Meet the Robinsons, where they mess up and they make all these mistakes and they celebrate and they say, you know, it's okay to fail. We all fail at things, and that's how we learn and we grow from it. And I think sometimes in our society we get too caught up in the facade that we don't have all these faults and things that are wrong with us. And we all know we all do. And so really, it's talking about it with your friends, with your family, and destigmatizing it one person at a time.
Greg Hudnall, the social isolation that our anonymous caller mentioned, I mean, that is exactly what you're trying to confront when you hold these intervention meetings and educational seminars. What are some of the issues that you bring up that people want to know about in these meetings, and how do you address that?
You know, it's interesting, especially in the rural isolated communities. We've been down on the reservation working in areas that there is lack of support and a very close-knit community. We talk about the importance that every child needs a significant other, someone that they can turn to, someone that they can trust. The research shows that 8 out of every 10 students who complete suicide have given some kind of warning, some kind of sign that if people understood what those signs were, then they'd be able to at least try to get help for them. We talk about the importance of reaching out and providing that system, and it's like what both Doug's talked about, that moving away from the stigma. NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness, has a great commercial that shows these four hefty steel workers that are sitting there and during lunch, and one of them takes a pill, and the other three start to make fun of him because he's taken an antidepressant. And then all of a sudden, one of them steps back and says, wait a minute, don't you take heart medication? Don't you take a cholesterol pill? So it's the same kind of concept that we need to understand that we can get help for mental illness if we have the courage to step out and educate others.
Dr. Gray, our time is short, but briefly, what are the warning signs, and what if you see these signs in somebody, a classmate, in a roommate, in a spouse, a friend?
Well, the most common diagnosis is depression that leads to suicide. So And the two cardinal symptoms of that are being sad all day long or not being able to enjoy anything. And I think you could say to somebody, are you having trouble with your mood? Are you sad? How much of the time? Sometimes I'll just say, what percent of the time are you happy? That's a good question to ask. And then, are you enjoying life? What are you enjoying? I think that if it's bipolar, you're looking at mood swings. Schizophrenia is going to be more obvious. People are going to be hallucinating or having delusions. Substance abuse is a tougher one to address, but I think it's really important to say, hey, I'm your friend or I'm your family member. I'm concerned about your drinking. I'm concerned about your drink. Can we talk about it? One thing I didn't mention is if you have somebody in your family that's kind of out of control and they won't get treatment, I often tell the healthy person that's, you know, maybe catching me in the hallway, I say, you need to get into treatment. They say, well, I'm not having the problem. I know, but if you get into treatment, we can show you how to help your loved one who's in trouble. And that's always an avenue that's important that often is left to the side. Mm-hmm.
And there are state resources as well. Doug Thomas?
Yes, there's a national number, actually, that goes to our state. So if you call from inside of Utah, it is answered by caring professionals up at the University Neuropsychiatric Institute, and that number is 1-800-273-TALK, 273-8255, and that's the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And we're really glad to have that resource available for our state and run by people in our state.
My final question for each of you is, where do we go from here? How do we get Utah's suicide rate down? Greg Hudnall.
Well, I think the most important thing is that we need to start talking about it, and we need to bring more awareness to it. We, in Provo School District, we were averaging a suicide a year for the first 8 years, and because of the work in the community and the extraordinary efforts by professionals, we haven't had a suicide in 6 years. So the proof is in the pudding. It's out there. We now need to expand it across the state and do more things to help educate and provide that support to those young kids who are struggling.
Dr. Thomas?
It's a multifaceted approach, like has been said. We need more community awareness, more stigma busting activities, and more people willing to say, hey, I have a mental illness too, and look at me. It's not a condemnation of anyone, and I think often people take it that way. We need to reduce the access to lethal means. We need more trained and educated, both paraprofessionals and professionals and lay people, that recognize the signs and symptoms of someone who may be having suicidal thoughts and is willing to talk to them about it, to be an adult ally, like Greg said, to young people. And we need to continue to create policy that will help address these issues.
And Dr. Gray?
I agree. It's multifaceted and too many areas to discuss right now. But just as one example, I think psychiatrists, in my profession, we need to get into the offices of pediatricians and internal medicine doctors and family practice, so that helps destigmatize what's going on. And also, we're right there to help them with the patients. And I think you're going to see medicine evolve over the next 10 years in that direction.
Dr. Doug Gray is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Utah. Doug Thomas, assistant director of the Utah Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. And Greg Hudnall, associate superintendent of Provo School District. And gentlemen, thanks very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll turn to planning for a healthcare crisis by preparing a medical plan. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Does your family know how you want to deal with medical decisions if you're in an accident or get a chronic illness? A new push to get Utahns to have an advanced care directive on file is underway, and joining me now to define exactly what that is and how we should approach end-of-life decisions is Erin Donnelly. She is the former director of end-of-life program development for Intermountain Healthcare, currently in strategic planning at Primary Children's Medical Center. And Erin Donnelly, thanks for joining me in studio today. Thank you. Do you have a medical plan? Why did you decide to draft a health care directive? Give us a call and share your thoughts. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. An advance directive. Erin, define that for us.
Sure. In Utah, an advanced healthcare directive has two parts to it. This is something that in the past couple of years, the state of Utah took these two parts and put them together in one form to make it more convenient for patients and members of the community to put all of their information in one place. So the first part is where you define a healthcare agent. This was historically called defining a power of attorney for healthcare. And this is the person that you want to make decisions for you if you're at any point unable to make decisions for yourself. And then the second portion of the Utah Advanced Healthcare Directive is where you put your wishes for care under certain circumstances. And this was historically called the living will. And so you may have an old document that is a power of attorney for a healthcare or a living will, and those are also valid in Utah. But now we have this one combined form, and that is what Senator Pat Jones's resolution was pushing, was to get people to fill out these forms and have these discussions with their family and get these forms on file with their doctor and their hospital.
And just as some background, there was a joint resolution passed by the House and the Senate, signed by the governor last week, encouraging Utahns basically to get your plans in place. Why do you advise people to spell out a healthcare plan?
So this is really about knowing and honoring an individual's wishes and choices for healthcare. So a lot of people have thought about living wills or advanced directives as something you only fill out if you don't want certain types of care, if you want people to withhold care from you. And that's not true. You can actually fill it out to say anything. Some individuals want absolutely everything under every circumstance. And but studies have shown that about 80% of Americans don't. And if you don't spell those things out and we don't know what you want, the default in this country is that we provide everything. And so if people don't have an advance directive, that means a large number of people are getting care that isn't in line with their wishes, their values, their goals for themselves in terms of healthcare. So this is really about keeping choices and decisions in your hands at all stages of care, even if you can't express them verbally or written at any point.
Mm-hmm. The advanced care directive, the power of attorney, the living will, do you need a lawyer for this?
You don't. It used to be that you had to have them notarized. And so that was a barrier to getting these completed because some people would want to have them filled out, but they'd think, oh, I've got to go find a notary. You know, this is too much work, so I'm not going to worry about it. They've made it easier. And so the Utah Advanced Healthcare Directive, where you can both designate a power of attorney and fill out a living will, just has to be signed by an unbiased witness. So you sign it yourself, and then you get a friend or a neighbor or a coworker to sign it as well. And they're not attesting to the fact that they agree with your wishes. They don't even have to read the document. All they're signing is to say that they know that this is your document.
And that you actually signed
and
it.
And that you actually signed it. Exactly. That's what they're attesting to. And so, and it is important that it is an unbiased witness. They don't want a family member. You don't want your caregiver signing it. You really want somebody who can sign it and not have a strong opinion one way or the other about what you are choosing.
Mm-hmm. Erin Donnelly, she's currently in strategic planning at Primary Children's Medical Center, the former director of end-of-life program development for Intermountain Healthcare. And we're talking about advanced directives. What is that, you ask? It's a healthcare plan for that what-if situation. If you get incapacitated, if you're very, very sick and can't make those health decisions yourself. 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255. Erin Donnelly, it can be a bit dicey approaching your parent, your child, your spouse to talk about these what-ifs. You know, how do you kind of start the conversation?
Well, I think the first thing is we've got to start thinking about advanced directives as not just something for someone who's currently in a health crisis or who's necessarily older. I'm 29 years old. I have an advanced directive. It makes the conversation a lot more comfortable when you're having it at that point. I've had the conversation with my husband, with my family, and we don't see anything looming on the horizon for me in terms of a health crisis. But it's something that I want to be prepared for, just in case. And so I think that's the first thing, is to try to approach this before a health crisis. That's the best time to have these conversations in a rational manner.
So don't wait until you're on the surgery table.
Exactly.
You've got like 15 minutes.
Which is what people commonly do. And that's not the right time to make this kind of important decision. The other thing is that, you know, the document really helps to start the conversation. And that was the idea behind Senator Jones's resolution, was to get it out there that we need to start these conversations. The document is not the end all. So it's really more about the entire advanced care planning process. And that is having these conversations with your parents, with your loved ones, making sure everyone understands what you want, and then getting it onto the document so you can share that with your healthcare providers. And you can share that with other members of your family who may not be nearby and able to partake in these conversations on a regular basis.
You mentioned that you can put anything in this, but I'm just curious, how specific can you really be? I mean, can you spell out, I want to die at home, or I don't want to be on life support for more than 3 days? I mean, can you be that detailed?
Yeah, there is. There are blank areas where you can write in special things, special wishes that you want. But they've also made it easy where there's some multiple choice sections. So if you don't want to go into that much detail, you can choose what you want under certain circumstances. And it's very specific about the circumstances. So that's the other thing as well. It's not something that because I say that I don't want things that prolong my life, such as life support or feeding tubes, doesn't mean that they won't do that if I'm in a condition where I will recover. It's really looking at when it's been determined that you probably won't recover. And you can choose, you can spell out those circumstances. So you can say they have a selection for, I have a condition and I'm unlikely to recover. They have a selection for, I no longer recognize my family and friends and that's unlikely to change. So there's specific circumstances spelled out. In some cases, you may want something, and in other cases, you may not want other things. And so you can be very specific around what you want, either by using that multiple choice system or by actually physically writing it out on the form.
In some ways, this requires you to kind of dig deep, you know, and reflect on how you view death, or you know, how your religious values impact these healthcare choices.
Exactly. And some people choose to get their religious leaders or people within their faith involved in these discussions. There is actually an organization in La Crosse, Wisconsin, which is a smaller town in Wisconsin, that is really focused on advanced care planning over the past decade. And they've gotten to the point where nearly all patients who pass away that are over the age of 18 in La Crosse have an advanced directive in place, and their wishes are honored. And they've really done that by making it a community value. And so when a patient comes into the hospital and they ask them if they have an advance directive, they also ask their family members who are there who are not sick, do you have an advance directive? They've worked with clergy in the community to work with their congregations around advance directives. Because like you said, there is, depending on your faith and beliefs, you might have different opinions on how you view what you want in end-of-life care. And so they've done pushes within those faith communities, in their community, to get people to fill out these advance directives. So it is.
Has there been any resistance, though? Because it does kind of come right up against that line of assisted suicide. And I'm just wondering if you get people a little hesitant because it's on that border.
Well, I think there is confusion around that because assisted suicide is illegal in the state of Utah. So you cannot put in you're welcome to write in, I would like assisted suicide in my advance directive, but it can't be followed because it is illegal. And so that is one of the rules. It's not about that. It's about when the natural progression of death is happening, what do you want at that stage to prolong life? And so that's I guess, the difference. It's not about causing death, but it's about choosing to withdraw things that would prolong life.
Mm-hmm. This new push encouraging Utahns to write down a health plan. How many people have actually done this? Do we know?
I don't have exact numbers. There have been surveys across the country, and somewhere between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 Americans has an advance directive. But one of the really interesting things was that AARP did a survey of physicians and found that about 2/3 of patients who had an advance directive, their primary care physician wasn't aware of it. So that's the other important piece. It's not just about filling out the document, but it's about sharing it with those who will be involved in your healthcare decision making. So your physician and important members of your family or friends.
We'll put a link on our website, kcpw.org, to these forms. But just very quickly, we've only got about 10 seconds left. But once you've got a plan, Erin Donnelly, can you change it?
Yes, you can change it at any time. There's multiple ways you can change it. You can even change it verbally by just saying, this isn't what I want any longer. But we would encourage people to fill out a new form. The form with the latest date automatically becomes the valid form.
Erin Donnelly with Primary Children's Medical Center, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.